Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we begin our show by talking about how you can become a three-minute outdoorsman, as a matter of fact. One of my guests today is making it really easy to do that. He's going to be with us now for, the next 45 minutes or so, and we're really looking forward to having him talk with us. His name is Robert Zink. He is the Breckenridge Chair in Ornithology at the Bell Museum of Natural History at the University of Minnesota and is the author of The 3-Minute Outdoorsman, Wild Science from Magnetic Deer to Mumbling Carp. And I tell you, I really, really enjoyed this book. And I just read from the book jacket. He humorously bridges the gap between esoteric information and nature as we have come to know it. Robert Zink distills the latest news from the world of science into 3-minute bursts of irresistible lore for the layman. And in these brief, engaging essays, readers will discover how deer use the Earth's magnetic field for orientation, a lost tradition at loon hunting in South Carolina, how porcupine quills are advancing new ideas about delivering vaccines, why deer antlers can model bone regeneration for amputees, and a whole lot more, covering a broad range of wildlife topics. And it's a very, very engaging book, and I'm really pleased to welcome him to the microphones today. Robert Zink, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Well, Larry, no problem. Thank you very much for the introduction. It was very flattering.
Well, it's you've done a wonderful job here, and as I have to tell you that I'm also a professor. I'm at the UW-Madison and do some hunting and fishing myself, and have done some research on, especially on fishermen behavior. I'm a social scientist, so I really enjoy reading about research. But you have made the these stories so engaging. What inspired you to do it?
Well, you know, in my day job, I'm a professor like you are, and we I tell kids that my job is to take a simple idea and make it real complicated so that when I teach you this, then you'll think that I'm a brilliant teacher and you've learned a lot. But in fact, we take our future scientists from the member of the public, where they can speak with everybody and they all speak the same language, and then we train them to become scientists in a particularly narrow field. So I think of it as going down into a funnel. And then when you get into the neck of the funnel, pretty soon you can only talk to a couple of people that have the same language that you do. And then you learn interesting things, but you're no longer able to communicate with the people up in the big part of the funnel who all speak the same language.
Yeah.
So I decided that the things I learn about in my day job are interesting to my friends who aren't university professors, who are just as smart as I am. They just don't speak the same language. And that I wanted to try and start telling people about some of the new exciting discoveries that are happening in the natural world from a wide variety of topics without putting it in a way that they can read it and understand it without knowing the language that was in the original paper.
And you have such a broad range of interests. I mean, that's one of the really engaging and fun things about your book.
Well, I'd say that probably most every essay I've written because I've learned something about it, where you just wanted to like hit yourself upside the head and go, duh, that's amazing. How could I not have known that? And I'm glad that I do know that. And so I have a friend who owns a garbage business and drives the truck once in a while. And this time of year, he's not so fond of doing that. But, he's every bit as smart as I am. And I like to think that if he would like to know about it, I'd like to tell him about it in a way that doesn't require him spending 6 years in graduate school.
Yeah. Robert Zink, our guest, author of The 3-Minute Outdoorsman. He is a professor at the University of Minnesota, professor of ornithology. It's great to have him with us today as we talk about it. You might want to join in yourself How did you learn about the outdoors? What do you have to, yet to learn that you'd like to know more about? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question or a comment there, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. Again, the number 1-800-642-1234. So we have stories about ducks, about deer, about antlers, about fish, about turkeys, snow geese and polar bears, just a whole broad range of topics that we can talk about, and even walking with Fido. That was kind of an interesting piece. And you know what impresses me? You're writing about the research of others, and you do a nice job of describing the research and how the research was conducted. And one of the really fascinating things to me was the ingenious way that so much of this research gets done.
Yeah, a lot of the papers that I write about, I'm just kind of amazed that I got started on this, quite a few years ago when two colleagues of mine were interested in a bird called the Labrador duck, an extinct bird, never much known about it, and most of what we know about it is based on a few preserved specimens in museums, like stuffed ducks.
Yep.
And in museum collections, we also have, like mine at the Bell Museum, we have collections of eggshells. So just like you can do at Easter, you can take a bird egg and drill a little hole in it, get all the contents out of it, and then you preserve that as a natural history specimen. And if you ever wanted to know about the eggshells of a bird or a Labrador duck, that's what you'd have. So it turned out there were 7 eggshells in museums around the world that were attributed to the Labrador duck. And so these two researchers got all those 7 specimens, went to the museums, injected some solution into the eggs and gently rinsed them around and then dumped it out. And what they got from it was a little bit of the DNA that was present in the dried membranes that were on the inside of the eggshell, which came from the female that laid the eggs. Then they went and they found some of these specimens, these stuffed ducks, took a little sample from underneath the feathers, little skin from a 100-year-old bird, got some DNA from that, and they sequenced it. So now they have essentially barcodes that identify the duck and identify the eggshells. And when they compared them, they found that none of the eggshells thought to be Labrador ducks were Labrador ducks. They were mallards, scoters, and one other different kind of duck. And, that was a really cool little piece of detective work using some really sophisticated DNA technology that if you read their paper, it might be kind of hard to kind of figure out what they did or why they did it. But I read it and went, that's hilarious. All 7 eggs, none of them are Labrador ducks. It turns out duck eggs are kind of a dime a piece in some groups, hard to tell apart. So I wrote a little article called What Little We Knew About the Labrador Duck Just Got Littler. It turned out none of the eggs were from Labrador duck. And so I sent it into a local newspaper where I published a lot of my essays. And I said, okay, this is kind of esoteric and it's kind of, it's about a duck, but, it's a hunting and fishing newspaper. You're probably not going to be interested in it. And the editor wrote back and said, what do you mean not interested? May I please print this article? Now, in 150 or more scientific publications of mine, no editor has ever asked me that. And you may have had the same experience.
Yes.
And so I thought, well, somebody was interested in this the way I wrote it up, and it was a little humorous, and so then I got started, and whenever I saw a paper in a field that maybe wasn't mine, I read about it, and I try to blend it with experiences I've had, and try and just put in plain language what these people found, and that I thought people would be interested in knowing.
Well, it really is fascinating. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in with their own questions or comments. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You had a question about the wildlife that you know something about, would like to know more. I hope you'll join in. We've we may be able to help out here, or at least our guest may be able to help out. Robert Zink, Breckenridge Chair in Ornithology at the Bell Museum of Natural History, University of Minnesota, author of The 3-Minute Outdoorsman, Wild Science for Magnetic Deer to Mumbling Carp. And sort of section of your book, it's a collection of essays on deer. And I think you start with game management and urban deer comes into play. And you talk about directional deer. That's an example of, some really interesting research. And as you point out, why hadn't anybody noticed it before? Talk about that.
Yeah, so, I do research on the evolutionary genetics of birds, and I teach ornithology, but I'm an avid deer hunter and duck hunter and turkey hunter and just outdoors person. And so I saw this paper in a really prestigious journal called PNAS, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and I skimmed the abstract because it was about deer, and it claimed that for centuries, farmers, herders, outdoors people, hunters, farmers, all had not noticed that when large ungulate animals, like cows, for example, are not stressed, they tend to head in a magnetic north direction. And I thought, well, that can't be right. So I looked in their paper to see how they determined this. And they got their information by looking at images from Google Earth.
Yeah.
As you know, you can. And I said, well, send me your coordinates. I don't believe you. So the author sent me the coordinates, and there I was looking at a herd of cows in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Most of them, 80, 90% of them were facing magnetic north. And I said, okay, well, one sample being enough to convince me. And so, they found that throughout the world, throughout different times of the year, different times of the day, cloudy, rainy, whatever they could get an image, on average, when they're not stressed, the deer face magnetic north. Now, if you've been on a farm, you know that when it's time to get milked or there's some food being put out, the deer go to where it is no matter what direction it is. So it's a caveat when they're not stressed. But then I thought, well, deer, no way. How could they have figured that out? You can't see deer on Google Earth. They went out in the winter in the Czech Republic, and they found deer beds. Have you ever found a white-tailed bed in the winter?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. In the snow? So you can actually tell the longitudinal direction of the deer and often which end the head was at. And if you draw a line through these, it turns out they're more often than not magnetic north. And so this is just really weird. I mean, why would these animals be doing this? I mean, the first thing is that we didn't really know they had this ability to use the Earth's magnetic field as a compass. We knew birds did, but we didn't know cows and deer did. And the only thing I can come up with is the following idea. If you're an animal like a deer in the winter who depends on being in a herd for safety, more eyes, more ears, more confusion to predators, and something scatters you, if you just walk in a random direction, it's going to take you a long time to get back together. But if you all walk magnetic north, you might be able to get back together a lot sooner than you otherwise would. So I read this and went, you got it. That's amazing. Gene, my friend that drives a garbage truck, would like to know about this. So I wrote about it.
Yeah, it's a very, very, very engaging story. Our guest today, Robert Zink, author of The 3-Minute Outdoorsman. I'm Larry Mueller. Cynthia Schuster, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network as we talk about the world of wildlife today with Robert Zink, the author of The 3-Minute Outdoorsman. Join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. You write about a fish as well. I'm going to skip around a little bit here. You write about fish as well, and you talk about how recreational fishing alters fish evolution.
Well, I'm a fisherman. I have to admit I'm more of a walleye perch northern guy than a bass guy, but I saw this paper about recreational fishing, and I thought, well, that's interesting. I mean, most of us fish all the time, and we never think that what we could do could influence fish evolution, but I'll give it a read. And I guess I would start out by saying that my preconceived and erroneous notion about bass is that they're all cut from the same mold, and whether they bite at your lure depends on whether you're very good at where you throw it and what the lure looks like and whether the fish is hungry. Is that what you think?
Yep, that's what I thought. Well, I'm a musky fisherman, so I have a whole different view of it, but go ahead.
Yeah, I love the fish of 10,000 casts. I caught one by accident once, so now I don't have to fish for them. So I thought that that's kind of how bass bit lures, is kind of on a whim. But it turns out there's genetically different bass. Some are predisposed to be really aggressive, and some are predisposed to be less so. And male bass guard the nest of eggs that the female lays that they fertilize, and they also flap their fins around and provide more oxygen to the eggs to help them develop better. And it turns out that more aggressive males are better dads than less aggressive ones, so that if a sunny comes by the eggs and would like to eat them, the male bass will chase them away or eat the sunfish. And so this also leads to the more aggressive male bass being the first ones taken out of a lake by bass fishermen, because they're more predisposed, they're more aggressive to bite at a lure. And the composition of lakes then, the bass population changes to be the less aggressive males. I mean, they still attack a lure, obviously, once in a while. Less aggressive, but they also tend to be poorer fathers. They're not as good at fanning the eggs, and they're not as good at defending the nest. So this puts a sort of a selection pressure on the bass, so that we're shifting them from more aggressive males to males that might breed at a smaller size and are less aggressive and aren't the best dads. And I thought, wow.
Yeah. Wow. Who'd have
thunk it?
Wow is right. Mike in Green Bay has a question for you. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I was just kind of curious, talking about the deer and the cows facing north. Could that explain my dog doing circles before he finally lays down? Is he orienting himself to the to magnetic north?
That's a great question. I've always read that when dogs do that, and mine do that too, and it's really annoying when they do it on the bed, that they're kind of, it's a ancient behavior that they use to sort of flatten the grass down that they're about to bed down in. But if I may, Larry,
yeah.
There was a paper that appeared on the magnetic behavior of dogs as well.
Oh.
And this one's not in the book because it just came out.
No.
But it's just even weirder. So these people that did the deer study and the cows wanted to know if when dogs go to the bathroom, they face north when they do it. Now, what's your initial impression?
I would have no idea.
Well, I got three dogs, and they go out in the backyard, and you know they go and go where the other dogs went. They're very habitual. However, that's not what these people did. They took dogs out into areas that they really hadn't been before, and so they weren't like at home. You know, and they weren't going on a favorite post or something, and they discovered that, like I predicted, the direction a dog faced when it did its business was random. And I said, ha, I got one right, finally. But then it turns out that the Earth's magnetic field, and I'm not a physicist, but my understanding is the Earth's magnetic field goes through periods where it's very calm and then where it's more agitated, for lack of a better word. When the magnetic field is stirred up, it's much harder to use it as a compass than when it's calm. And so these people had data on the Earth's magnetic field, and so they went back and they looked at periods of magnetic calm, and they found that more often than not, I mean, not 100% of the time, but more often than not, when dogs do their business during magnetic calm, they're facing?
North.
You got it. And so then the question is, What are they doing that for? Why would it matter? Other than, the only thing I can think of is our dogs are genetically basically the same as what other animal? It's a wolf.
The wolf.
Our dogs are wolves. Our dogs and wolves mark their territories. Maybe it helps to have a compass if you want to go about and mark your territory. And when it's magnetic calm, dogs can use the magnetic field to orient and maybe know where they're going so they can more efficiently mark their territory. That's speculation, but the observation is there. Magnetic calm, dogs face north. Go figure.
Chuck in Waupaca, thank you for calling. Hi, Chuck.
Hi. Just had an observation the other day that I was a little embarrassed about. Here in the north of our house, and every few minutes I just watched chewing with a beautiful velvet rack, and all of a sudden he would stop chewing, and then a bulge would appear in his cheek.
Oh, this is the buck deer.
Yeah, and I thought that looks like cud chewing. And I've hunted deer all my life. I'm a senior citizen, and watching that, I think, are deer ruminants? So I looked it up, and by golly, deer are ruminants. And I've had breakfast with a bunch of old-timers today, and I'm asking around the table. All of them are not with that either.
I mean, you were breaking up a bit there, Chuck, but Bob, did you get the gist of that?
I got the gist of it, yeah. Deer are definitely ruminants. And the sign of that is if you've when you've cleaned a deer, if you've accidentally opened the stomach,
yeah,
it's not at all. It's amazing that some animal inside could smell that bad and taste so good. But so do cows, and so yes, they're definitely ruminants. They chew a cud. But what he started to say reminded me of a condition that deer have, where it's a condition called lumpy jaw. And I forget exactly what causes it, but if this deer, if this lump persisted, then it would be a condition that the deer had that's not a sickness, an illness. But if they're just chewing their cud, then, yeah, that's kind of what deer do.
Yeah.
Where they go bed down and kind of enjoy lunch a second time.
Thanks, Chuck, for calling. Jim in Woodstock, Illinois, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. I was taught in a biology class somewhere along the way that male deer and elk and animals like that grow big horn sets to, just to show the females how much extra protein they've got. They can waste it on the antlers. And I was wondering if somebody goes by me in a Bentley convertible or a 500-horsepower car, is that the same evolutionary pathway?
Well, first of all, the deer antlers, I think, have dual functions. Male deer judge each other's fighting ability by the size and shape of the antlers. And it's clear a deer with really, you know, a 170-class deer is going to take one look at a 125-class antler deer, and the little guy's going to just take off. So they use it for fighting each other, and it's a way that females can say, yeah, he's probably got pretty good genetics. But when you get into the question of sexual selection, which that topic is about, in humans, there are some signals that we haven't totally left our evolutionary ancestry behind. But the evidence is always clouded by the fact that we have certain social and moral issues that we superimpose on our behavior that might, obfuscate is the word, our past evolutionary history, but no, we definitely do things that are consistent with that. I forget, there's some good data that women do look at men's cars and make judgments based on the car.
Yeah. So there you go, Jim. Oh, man. He mentioned the antlers again. The medical field, as you report in the book, the medical field is pretty interested in antlers as well.
Yeah, I've always, thought, boy, one of the worst things that would happen is to lose a limb because it's, other than prosthetics, which are getting really good, there's not much you could do, at least in the past. But when you think about deer antlers, they're bone. A deer is a vertebrate animal like us, a lot of similarities, and this bone breaks off or drops off, it actually drops off every year, but then the following spring it starts up and they grow it again. So medical researchers are interested in what happens to the base of the antler when the antler is shed in the fall that doesn't result in it being just completely turned off and never allowed to grow new bone cells again at the base. And so they figure if they could see how deer do this annually, then it might give them some insight into whether or not you could do some either, some medical tricks to regenerate limbs on humans that suffer, severe breaks.
I think it's really interesting stuff. Rich in Manitowoc, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Great. Appreciate your call.
Hey, Rich.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I have a question. I'm a fisherman like the two of you, but I fish primarily salmon on Lake Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And when I leave early in the morning, sometimes it's 50-50 decision of whether to head south or north, not depending on other variables like where the fish are biting or where the commercial fishermen have their nets. Sometimes it's just, well, what am I going to do when I come out of the piers with the boat? Am I going to head south or am I going to head north? And it seems like more times than not, when other fishermen sometimes catch your fish south, I've made the wrong decision and headed north. So the question is, how many times when humans have a 50-50 decision of heading in one direction or the other, they tend to head north?
Oh, what a great question. I don't have the foggiest idea.
Okay, well,
but that's a great idea. I mean, in some of the talks I've given about this, this comes up all the time. And, when the dog study came out, people started asking, hey, I wonder if our toilets face north or not. But so we don't know exactly how much humans can use that magnetic north heading for anything. Personally, I think that humans have a very wide range of abilities to sense the Earth's magnetic field, and I'm at the low end. I've lived in the same place for 22 years, and I still don't know which way north is unless I stop and think about the major highway nearby and what direction it goes. But then I've been with people who could be in a basement in a room in a state they just arrived at, and they know which way west is or north. And I'm like, how do you know that? I just don't have it. So I think that humans have the ability to sense the Earth's magnetic field, but some not as well as others. What about you, Larry? Are you directionally oriented or directionally challenged?
Well, I as a younger guy, when we go fishing and musky fishing in northern Wisconsin, I always said I always want to sleep north with my head facing north.
You're kidding?
No. That's what? Exactly. I have, because I wanted to be north.
Really?
And I wanted my head there.
Well, I'm also partly red-green colorblind, so maybe there's a link between sensing the Earth's magnetic field and sensing being able to detect colors, but I don't know about that. Anyway, that's a great question.
Yeah.
I think there's something to be explored there about whether or not when we have a choice and there's no obvious reason what to do, we head north just by sort of the default. Maybe that's the default setting.
I would be more inclined to head north. I'm sure of that. Bill in Madison. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm curious, Bob, are you familiar with the name Carl Richter?
I can't pull anything up immediately.
He donated, he was an ornithologist, self-taught. He donated his collection of over 10,000 specimens to the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay many years ago.
Uh-huh.
And my dad worked with him at the power company, but Carl did this part-time and at night and weekends, and I was in his house as a little boy, and you didn't see any furniture. It was wall-to-wall boxes, and it was just amazing. So I just thought, being in your field, you might have heard of his name or knew of him.
No, I don't know that collections very well. It's now illegal to have private collections, and so most of them have made their way into museums. And I'm glad to hear that one has as well, because a specimen in a museum, like Labrador duck eggs or whatever, are the only permanent record of biodiversity that we have. And so they're like, I say it to people, they're not like just rare books in a library. They're like the only copy of a rare book in a library. Because no one could go back and duplicate this collection, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so look him up sometime. He specialized in the yellow rail, a tiny, tiny little shorebird with a pea-sized egg, and it was just amazing.
What's his name again?
Carl Richter. R-I-C-H-T-E-R, I believe.
Richter, okay. Yeah,
yeah, University of Wisconsin, Green Bay.
We had a student here a long time ago who worked on yellow rails. His name was Scott Stahlheim. And I think he did some of his work in Wisconsin, so maybe they collaborated.
May have. Yeah, thanks a lot, Bill. Appreciate your call very much. As long as we're talking about other authors, I'm not sure if you know Tom Heberlein, that name, from the University of Wisconsin.
I have to confess I don't.
He's an environmental sociologist and has a book that's kind of like yours in some respects, in that it's a collection of essays about public attitudes, and it's called Navigating Environmental Attitudes. And it's he's popular essays about navigating environmental attitude, about environmental attitudes. His is a collection that sort of builds to a finish, whereas I think yours is a little different in terms of its organization.
Oh, no, that's fine. It's random. There's no question about it.
Oxford has just brought that out in Kindle, and it's in its fourth printing. It's Navigating Environmental Attitudes.
Huh.
And if you're interested in that side of it, that is clearly a book that you might want to take a look at.
Yeah, I've been going to write about a paper I read a couple of years ago in which these scientists were interested in knowing or kind of documenting the behavior of drivers when they encountered various wildlife on the road.
Hmm.
So they did things like they put out turtles and snakes and you know, rabbits and things like that, just to see what people did. And all I'll say at this point is that you don't want to be a snake on the road.
Yeah. Yeah, people would go out of their way to...
pretty much. Yep.
Paul in West Bend had a question that relates to, and here once more, we've got Magnetic North, but it's slightly different in all parts of the planet. And so wondering if the animals, the orientation is in different parts of the world.
That's a good question. Magnetic North and Geographic North also can differ somewhat. And then there are those magnetic storms, and there are anomalies in areas like if there's lots of iron in the ground, the magnetic north may be slightly different there than it is 200 miles away. So in the southern hemisphere, all the cows pointed magnetic north in the stand in the north. I don't know that they don't have any data on deer, and this whole field of magnetic biology is relatively new, and people are just starting to find out some of these amazing things that animals do that we just didn't notice because apparently we don't have quite as strong a sense of magnetic directionality.
You point out in your book, and you talk a lot about cats and their predation on birds, which is well documented and well known, I think. But you also have a really interesting chapter on, I think you titled it Reconsider Your Walk with Fido or something like that.
Yeah, I'm a dog owner, and I love cats if they're inside.
Yeah.
Cats outside to me are ecological pollution. They don't belong there. They should not be allowed outside. On the other hand, I don't think anything of, you know, running my dog around outside, even when we're not hunting. But we do have a law in Minnesota, and I think you do too, that you're not supposed to be running your dog out in the woods when things like grouse or pheasants are breeding.
Yeah.
Because it does disrupt them. But these guys went a little bit farther, and I think it was in Australia. They had different kinds of parks. They had parks where there were no pets allowed, period. Then they had parks where dogs were allowed on leashes. And I would have thought, it's not going to matter. But it turns out that when birds are confronted, it's an environment with lots of dogs being walked around. This introduces a level of stress that results in them being less successful breeders and maybe, you know, laying fewer numbers of eggs because they don't know that the dog's on a leash. Maybe they're thinking their evolutionary history is saying fox or coyote, heightened danger. You might want to hedge your bets a little bit and not spend a lot of your energy on reproduction in this particular place.
And so your conclusion to that was, I thought, interesting.
Well, the conclusion seems to be that birds in these parks where they allow dogs don't reproduce as well, and there's not as many of them. They tend to avoid it. So maybe, you know, it's one study. You know, it's suggestive. And maybe if you get enough evidence of this sort, we need to be confining dogs to, you know, fewer and fewer places where they're allowed to run, and just kind of say, okay, that's how we're going to mitigate this effect on the local birds, is we're not going to do it in as many places.
Or at least, that's a very tough one. I know in some communities there's you know, dog parks are fine for most people as long as it's not in their own backyard.
Well, and you know, we certainly have plenty of laws about dogs running loose, and we have no laws about cats running loose. And the reason is that where it would occur is most city council levels. They feel that it's unenforceable, and they don't want to have ordinances on the books that are unenforceable. But I disagree. I think they are enforceable. You know, if your cat's outside in my yard, I'm going to call you, and then I'm going to call it in, and then, you know, you just have to suffer the same consequences if your dog's running around loose.
Yeah, we have two cats, and they are indoor cats. They get outside to go to the vet. That's pretty much when they get outside. And I have some bird feeders that are strategically placed next to nice windows where they can sit and watch the birds.
Yeah, that's great.
And
I mean, people say, you know, that's what cats do. They kill birds. Well, you know, our birds did not evolve in an ecosystem with a feline predator of that size and ability. So it's not fair. You know, cats should not be out killing birds. They're not part of our natural environment. And, you know, keep them inside. You know, I love cats. I had two. My wife is allergic to cats, so we're done with the cat thing. But I love cats, just not outside.
Well, this has been a lot of fun, Bob, talking to you today. And there are so many great stories that we in your book that we didn't cover at all. And so I hope people have a chance to see your book and to read it. Anyone with an interest in the outdoors is certainly going to benefit from your book, and I appreciate the chance to have you on and talk about it.
Well, I enjoyed it very much. I hope, you know, everything I wrote about, I learned something about, and I thought other people would like to know about, and maybe didn't speak the right language, but hopefully I've done that, so, you know, got around that problem for them, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate it very much. Robert Zink is the author of The 3-Minute Outdoorsman, Wild Science, From Magnetic Deer to Mumbling Carp. And we didn't get to the mumbling carp, or we didn't get to the coyotes and fox, or we didn't get to the relationship between snow geese and polar bears. Did you know there's a relationship there? And you're just going to have to get the book and take a look and read the book in order to find out what it is all about. World Elder Abuse Awareness. Here's, I'm going to switch gears here big time. World Elder Abuse Awareness Day was Sunday. And as the number of people in Wisconsin over the age of 65 continues to grow, we're going to take some time today to learn how to detect when abuse or neglect or exploitation may be happening. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and you can join in with your questions or comments, and maybe your experiences in this area of elder abuse. 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR or WPR.org, excuse me, or comment on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.